You've just landed in Anchorage. For the last 2 years, you've been planning an epic ice climbing vacation with friends. Finally, you've made it. That night you stay up late, watching the Eiger Sanction, getting psyched for what's to come.
But we shall continue with style.
But the next morning, whilst racking your gear, you make a startling realization. You forgot your ice tools. But lucky for you, you can get a new pair at the Hoarding Marmot, Anchorage's finest outdoor consignment shop, located in the heart of Spinard. The Hoarding Marmot has everything you need to get going on your next outdoor adventure, whether you're mountaineering, rock and ice climbing, hiking, packrafting, skiing, or more. The Marmot also has a fine selection of maps, guidebooks, yummy trail snacks, and other odds and ends to fill out your kit, plus great prices to fit any budget. Make sure and stop by the Hoarding Marmot next time you roll through town, or check them out online at hoardingmarmot.com.
Hello, let us begin by introducing ourselves. I'm Hans.
And I'm Franz.
And we want to pump you up.
Are you ready to get pumped? Well, head on over to the Alaska Rock Gym. They've been providing quality indoor climbing to the Anchorage community since 1995. Alaska Rock Gym is a great place to keep your forearms strong and your mind centered any time of year. With over 20,000 square feet of climbing, an entire floor of bouldering terrain, beautiful locker rooms, plus expanded cardio fitness and yoga rooms, Alaska Rock Gym has something for everyone. So to learn more, you can stop by to take a tour of the facility or check them out online at alaskarockgym.com. All right, let's get to the show. Sometimes it's hard to fathom that just 20 or 30 years ago, going on mountain adventures were much different than they are today. In our modern internet-connected world, we take for granted the luxuries afforded by the devices that we simply hold in our hands. Technology that gives us near-instant communication from pretty much anywhere around the globe. GPS tracking to assist with navigation. Weather reports so accurate that they can be predicted almost to the minute. There's an argument to be made that technology has made adventure less adventurous. But there was no lack of adventure in 1995 when climber John Climaco and his partner Andrew Brash found themselves en route to Pakistan, hoping to climb a 25,000-foot peak at the head of the Bal Toro Glacier called Chogalisa. Back then, Climaco and Brash were essentially dirtbag alpinists. In fact, they barely scraped enough money together to get to Pakistan, let alone pay for the permits and porters that would help them shuttle their gear for weeks just to get to the base of the climb. But as the journey began, getting to the base of Chogalisa would be the least of their troubles.
This was back, you know, before 9/11, but it was still a very touchy place. The U.S. Embassy in Islamabad had only recently been rebuilt after it had been bombed and destroyed. The cultural center that the U.S. Operated then in Islamabad was still, I think, just like a burnt husk. You know, it was a rough place. There'd just been a big terrorist attack at the Marriott. So it was a hot time to go to Pakistan. There weren't tons of people there, definitely not tons of Americans, that's for sure.
In addition to the political tensions of the time, it was a monumental and grueling task back then just to get a permit to climb in Pakistan. Remember, in 1995, the internet was basically in its infancy, so everything was written on paper and sent by mail, a sluggish process interspersed with a seemingly endless maze of red tape.
So we had to submit a big pile of paperwork. We worked with Nazir Sabir, who was the first Pakistani to climb K2, and Nazir came recommended to us through a bunch of different people. He ran a trekking agency, it's still there, and Nazir kind of helped shepherd us through the process. And essentially, to go to a place like this, I mean, all these expeditions, you always have to have a liaison officer of some sort. You know, oftentimes it's just like some government official was going to keep an eye on you and is supposed to, you know, liaise between the expedition and whatever's going on in the local country. But for Chogolisa, they actually sent an army officer with us. And that was kind of where the trouble started for us.
As John and Andrew sat on the plane, approaching the smoggy city of Islamabad, their minds were fueled with excitement for the coming adventure. They had prepared months for the climb, throwing all their energy and resources into the expedition, a trip they hoped would be a defining moment in their lives.
We landed in Islamabad and, you know, we'd barely left the airport before some cops stopped. You know, they saw our gear on the roof of the taxi. They stopped the taxi and shook us down, like, as we were driving out of the airport in Islamabad. Andrew and I were like, oh, my God, what have we gotten ourselves into? And we met our liaison officer, I think, the second day in Islamabad. And he was immediately in our face. He just started yelling at us and telling us, you know, you're nothing here in Pakistan. You know, I'm a captain in the Pakistani army. I have status here. You have no status here. You have no say on what happens. I will be in charge until you're on the mountain. And we're like, okay.
The duo had come prepared with a plethora of shiny new mountaineering gear. They even brought brand new plastic boots for their liaison officer. But he wasn't interested.
Brought this huge duffel bag of all this brand new gear that we'd put together for him, you know, from sponsors and from just buying it outright. And he, you know, he was picking up like things like, I remember he picked up, we gave him the same plastic boots that Andrew had. And he was like, I don't like this color. He just threw them on the other side of the room, you know, and we were like, oh God. Yeah, it was rough. And it turned out, you know, I mean, I don't have much to say in his name was Captain Muhammad Ayub. In his favor, but he had just come from the Siachen, and he told us that right away. You know, he was like, look, people are dying from cold and in this, the hell of the north, he called it, and this shouldn't happen to me, he said, so we need to stay in Islamabad for 2 weeks at least while I collect the proper equipment. And, you know, we were like, we don't have 2 weeks, we don't have 2 days, like, we don't have 10 cents of extra money on this trip. So we knew we were just going to have a contentious relationship with him from the beginning.
This would be the first of many delays. Captain Ayub, fresh off the war and with a new child born just 2 weeks prior, was in no rush to leave the comfort of the hotel. He insisted that they stay in Islamabad for 2 weeks while he collected the proper equipment.
So he was dragging his feet. He didn't want us to leave our hotel ever, which, you know, we didn't want to do. We managed to come up with an excuse to go out to Peshawar, another Pakistani city near the Khyber Pass. We wanted to check it out. Back in those days, you know, you could go to the gun bazaar and shoot, you know, mortars and, you know, anti-tank weapons. And I mean, anything you wanted, you could do it. And we got out there and, you know, there was some kind of civil unrest going on in Peshawar the day we drove out there. So we were on our way back, and I'll never forget. We were coming up to this checkpoint. The taxi driver was, you know, we had already kind of had a rough time in Pakistan, and the taxi driver was telling us that he really hated the government and he hated the police and this and that. And we'd been there for maybe 4 days. We'd already had enough of both. And he just randomly said, would you like to see a picture of my brother? And we said, sure. So he handed back this picture, and it was a body on a steel table in a morgue, the back half of its head. And it was a bloodbath, you know, and he was like, the police did this to my brother. And just as we're pulling up to a police checkpoint, and Andrew and I were like, oh my God, okay, I think we'll just stay in the hotel, you know, for the rest of the time until we can leave.
They eventually did leave, driving the Karakoram Highway to Skardu, the launch point for their expedition. The road, which back then was a treacherous multi-day journey, teetered its way over massive cliffs, with wrecked buses below, sprawled along the raging and roiling Indus River. And it didn't help that the drivers were all high as kites on hash. Finally, they arrived in Skardu.
We got up to Skardu, and we met our cook, that Nazir had arranged for us, and our Sirdar. And, you know, it was just, you know, it was like you read about, or at least, you know, I read about when I was a kid, there's like, you know, 200 guys, you know, that have all like walked from their villages at that point to get to Skardu to, you know, to have an opportunity to carry loads. And they're all screaming and throwing stuff. And so we got a bunch of guys together and we ended up caravanning with another expedition from the States that was going to Hidden Peak. Phil Powers and a bunch of guys were going to Hidden Peak. And so we kind of joined forces. So we had this Jeep caravan, you know, leaving Skardu. And the road out of Skardu, you know, the Karakoram Highway looks tame in comparison, because the road out of Skardu was just washing out everywhere and huge, you know, landslides and stuff. We just took to riding on the roof of the Jeep because we thought, if the thing goes over, at least we'll have a chance if we're on top of the Jeep, not, you know, not inside. So we, Andrew and I, rode on the top of the Jeep with all of our gear and stuff. And then I think the second day, this is when it really hit me where we were and what we were doing. The second day out of Skardu Road had, you know, imagine like a massive scree slope, like 2,000 foot scree slope, and the road was just washed away. And there was nothing, like it disappeared and down into the river below. And apparently these rains that had kept us from flying had triggered all these landslides. And so Jeeps had been trapped in places between the landslides on the road going up to Ascoli, the village where the road ends. And so we were going to try to shuttle all the loads over the landslides. The first up thing was the liaison officer from the Hidden Peak expedition had a box of dynamite with him, and he was, his plan first was to blow up the landslides and with the dynamite so we could keep going. We never used the dynamite, but I remember thinking to myself, you wanted a real adventure, this is it. Like, you might not even see the mountain or even base camp at this point. Like, this is how gnarly this place is.
On top of everything, John and Andrew were under increasing pressure due to their lack of funds. Every day, hour, minute, or even second wasted caused anxiety. They'd calculated they'd had enough rupees to pay the 40 porters on the way in, but if anything else went awry, they weren't sure they'd have enough to pay them on the way out. But once again, this turned out to be the least of their troubles.
And of course, we kept going. You know, we had one incident that seemed minor at the time, but within a few days, really became part of the kind of defining problem of the trip. We came to a rope bridge, you know, where there was like a, there was a cable strung across the river. And we had to cross in a basket one at a time. And so, you know, you need a rope to pull the basket back each time. And we got there with our, we had our 40 porters. And then right in front of us, there was an army group. And they were bringing, you know, ammunition and stuff up to the front line for the Siachen fight. So, you know, all just cases and cases of ammunition. They were going on donkeys. And they had donkeys on the other side of the river, donkeys on the near side, and they asked us if they could borrow our rope, you know, to pull the basket back. And we said sure, we had some rope for it, so we set it up with them, and then they used our rope and they went on their way, and then we crossed the river and retrieved the rope and everything. And that evening Captain Ayub asked us about this, and it was weird because he had been observing the whole thing. We couldn't figure out why he was asking questions about this, and we said, I said, he said, well, why did you give them the rope? And I said, well, they needed it. They didn't have one. And he said, they didn't have one. And I said, no. And he said, the army didn't have a rope. And I said, no, that's right. And he said, okay. So he made some notes in this little book that he was carrying. And I thought that was strange, but whatever. He was a strange guy. So we kept walking. And we eventually, we were almost to, a couple days later, just past the Trango group. Before we got there, this porter came back to us, one of the guys, and he told us that the porters wanted to do a double stage that day because they were, you know, all these different delays that they'd had getting onto the glacier were now on the Baltaro Glacier. They were running short on food and wood to cook. You know, they make fires every night to cook their chapatis. And we said, sure, no problem. Like, we're happy to do a double stage. We'll get to, you know, base camp sooner. So the porter turns around and he starts running back to Gori 2. And when we arrived at Gori 2, we thought we would see an empty place, just the army camp and all of our stuff on its way to Concordia. But no, all of our porters were sitting around and, you know, there were bags and stuff everywhere. And there was only one tent set up, and it was Captain Ayoub's tent. You know, he was passed out in his tent with his feet sticking out of the door. I can still see it. And so I thought, this is kind of weird. Okay. So I went over to his tent and I started talking to him about what was going on. And he said, you know, he was arguing against going. And I said to him, you know, look, these guys are running out of food and they're not going to be able to make fires. And he said, these Johnnies, you know, he waved his hand at all the porters. He said, these Johnnies don't know what's good for them. And I know what's good for them because I'm a captain in the Pakistani army. And if I have to beat each and every one of them to make them understand what's good for them, then I shall beat each and every one of them. I thought, oh my God. He said, no, we're not going. And the porters were all, you know, concerned and upset because this was going to mean they were going to spend a night, at least one night out on the glacier with no fire and no food. We didn't think that was, you know, that was very fair. So I pulled out the, you know, the rule and regulation book, which he had been, you know, for the whole trip so far, been waving in our face and quoting various problematic passages at us. And I said, well, it says right here that if the expedition leader and the liaison officer disagree on logistics, the expedition leader, and that was me, even though we were just an expedition of two people, you know, my word is final. My opinion is final. He said, fine. So, okay, so we sign off on this little piece of paper, and I go back over to talk to the porters, and I said, okay, well, you know, let's head to Concordia. And they were all sitting there, you know, finally one of them said, well, we can't go, and because this argument with Ayoub had taken maybe an hour or two. He was just too tired, you know, he was out of shape, and he was too tired, and he didn't feel acclimatized, and so he didn't want to go, but the porters had wanted to go, except now, what the result is, it's too late. You know, the sun was going to set. There's crevasses between Gori 2 and Concordia. And so they didn't want to go. They didn't feel it was safe. Unfortunately, they were unhappy. But, you know, they said, we just can't go. So I said, okay, well, 2 hours of negotiation wasted. But what can you do? You know, this is Pakistan. These things happen. So I go over to Captain Ayoub and I tell him, no, actually, he had started taking his tent down. And I said, we're going to stay here. And he looked at me and I've never seen anybody do this before or since. And I asked Andrew not long ago if he remembered the same thing. And he did. He started to shake. He was so angry. His whole body started to shake and his eyes bulged out, you know, and he starts beating his chest and he's screaming at me, you're joking with me. I'm captain in Pakistan Army. You do not treat me like slave. And he's screaming. I'm like, you know, relax. He's like, I will not relax. He's like, you have committed crimes against the state of Pakistan. You've been spying. I've been keeping notes and watching. And now you're toying with an officer of the Pakistani Army. And then he starts screaming in Urdu. And a couple of things happened simultaneously. First, you know, when he mentioned crimes, I thought, I don't know what he's talking about. Like, he must just be, you know, going off here in the state. So I'm trying to figure that out. And while I'm figuring out what's going on, the porters come crowding around. But then a minute later, the soldiers from Gori 2 come over and they're all armed. You know, they've got their Kalashnikovs. And I mean, you know, they didn't look like soldiers. They were all in track suits, you know, and whatnot, but they were very heavily armed. And they came over and Ayoub starts screaming at them. And the next second, these guys have all got their weapons, you know, leveled, like, at me. And I'm like, hands up, argument's over, you win. And he's like, no. He's like, the crime you've committed, he said, you insulted the Pakistani army over the rope at the bridge. And I said, what? He said, you know, you've insulted their training. You've insulted their equipment. You've insulted their, you know, their status. You've insulted me. He said, and you've been taking pictures of sensitive installations, and I need all of your film, and I need you to sign this confession of your crimes right now. And I thought, what just happened? Like, 1 minute we were walking up, you know, this incredible valley looking at the Trango Towers and all these beautiful mountains. And the next minute I've got a bunch of, you know, machine guns pointed at me, and I've got some people screaming at me in a language I don't understand and telling me I've committed crimes and they want my film and everything else. Things had gone absolutely crazy. So he eventually screamed himself out, I think just because of the altitude. And, you know, the soldiers sort of were standing there but didn't really know what to do. And so he told me to go get all my film. So I went into my tent, and what I did was, you know, I spooled up a bunch of my unexposed film because I knew somewhere in all the film I'd shot was going to be something problematic. So I spooled up all the old film that hadn't been used. I gave it to him in a bag. He gave me this confession, which I still have. And it was horrible. I mean, it was the type of stuff, you're definitely going to jail for a long time. And I just said, I'm absolutely not signing that. There's no way. I might as well sign my own, you know, death warrant. So we went back and forth quite a few times. And finally he said, fine, I'll sign it for you. And I was like, what? And he said, yes, I'm the, you know, captain in Pakistan Army, again, with this line. And, you know, my word is final. I'll sign the confession for you. We'll sort it out when we get back to Islamabad. And, you know, I said, no, I think we're going back to Islamabad tomorrow. Like, the expedition's over. That's it.
John and Andrew were crushed. They were also terrified as the situation was becoming more and more dire. They'd rolled the dice, and it was pretty clear they'd lost. With all their troubles mounting, they started to realize they wouldn't be able to muster the energy for the climb. So they decided to pack it up and just focus on trying to get back out safely. But when John told Captain Ayub about their plans to leave, well, this put another twist on their adventure.
I hadn't realized this would have this effect, but I called his bluff because he was paid by the day, by us. And so I don't think he expected us to cut the expedition short. And even though he didn't want to be there, you know, cash is cash. And he was probably making more on our expedition than he would make in a year in the army. So suddenly he was like, what do you mean? And I said, well, we can't, we're not going climbing at this point. Like, you're going to put me in jail. I want to go back to Islamabad and go to the embassy and see if I can straighten this mess out. So he sort of backed down and he said, well, I'm going to hold on to this confession. And if you behave yourself on the rest of the trip, you know, and you do each and everything that I tell you, we'll tear it up together at the end and everything will be fine. So I said, oh, okay. So I had to chew that one down for a minute.
And if things couldn't get any stranger, well, they did.
As I was sort of sitting there, one of the porters came up to me, or Sirdar porter, head porter, this guy, Sunib, who was an awesome guy. And Sunib came up to me and he had this, you know, had another famous line from the trip. He just said, we had taken really good care of the porters. You know, we had a lot of medical supplies with us. And so we took care of a lot of these guys, their various ailments along the way. And we had given them extra food and we had a lot of good gear for them, you know, all the stuff that you're supposed to bring back then, because again, it's probably different now, but then you had to just, you know, you had to outfit all the porters for time on the glacier. And we took it seriously. We didn't cheap out. We got them really nice stuff and they were grateful. And so the Sunib said, you know, you're a good man, John. You really, you know, you've cared for the Balti porters. And I said, oh, thank you, Sunib, you know. And he said, this shouldn't happen to you here. And I said, yeah. And he said, this Ayub is a very bad man. And I said, yes, he is. And he said, he doesn't like Balti people. He doesn't treat us fairly. He doesn't treat us like men. I said, yeah, I can see that. And he said, so tonight, inshallah, we'll slit his pig throat. And I was like, Sunib, are you sure? He said, absolutely. You know, he said, we can't tolerate this insult, you know, and we'll take care of it. And I said, okay, so now we've gone from really bad to even worse, inconceivably worse. And I said, Sunib, I'll tell you what, let's wait and see what happens when we get to base camp. And then if he's still a problem, we'll talk about it. And he said, okay, you're our leader. You tell us what to do. You know, as you know, I wrote about this trip a long time ago, and I started rolling the idea around in my mind, like, if we can't convince this guy, you know, people disappear all the time in the Karakoram. It happens all the time. And who would be the wiser if Captain Ayub ended up in a crevasse somewhere on the Baltara, never to be seen again? And I couldn't believe, you know, I was actually thinking about this, like, as if it was some type of rational choice to get out of this mess. But I was, because it was really, the situation had become completely, you know, unhinged.
Somehow, the ragtag expedition rolled on. Things were incredibly tense. But the next day, they made it to Concordia. And when John saw a group of Swiss trekkers heading down the glacier, he decided this was an opportunity.
So I pulled one of them aside, and, you know, Ayub didn't even want us talking to anybody, so I had to kind of do it on the sly, but I handed this letter to this woman, and I gave her a little bit of money, and I just said, just whatever you do, like, just don't mail this in Pakistan. Just wait till you get back to Switzerland and put this letter in the mail. So I was, you know, writing my folks to kind of give them some instruction as to what to do in case, you know, I didn't get out of there. And we got to base camp, and, you know, the circus sort of continued. Our cook quit at base camp. He was sick of dealing with Ayub, and Ayub left base camp to go find us another cook if he could find somebody. He found us quite a character. That's a whole other story. But at this point, we were sort of like, well, we've kind of reached a stalemate with this guy. There's a possibility that we could somehow deal with him in the mountains if we had to, if push really came to shove, literally. And but in the meantime, at least a stalemate is better than an active war. So let's try to climb this peak that we went through all this to climb.
By this time, the group had whittled down to just four: John and Andrew, the new cook, and of course, Captain Ayub. Finally, by mid-July, with the unsettled weather looking as good as it was going to get, John and Andrew finally set out for Chogolisa.
And we climbed up, you know, onto this ridge, the northeast ridge. And we climbed through this thing for 3 or 4 days, mostly at night. It was really hot. We did, you know, the climb at night. Conditions were bad. The snow was really rough, deep and unconsolidated. Tons of crevasses on the ridge. It was this, like, sort of thin of snow that we kept tunneling through, which was horrifying. Neither of us had ever seen anything like that before. You know, digging through the snow to try to find an anchor, and all of a sudden you pop through the ridge and you're looking down 1,000 feet down on the other side of this thing. And we got up somewhere around 7,000 meters. We had a camp. It's sort of fogged in. It's hard to describe, but it's sort of the ridge that we were climbing sort of borders about a 5,000 or 6,000 foot face that's part of a much bigger aspect of Chogolisa. And I think it's the last picture of Hermann Buhl ever taken on a ridge across the way. Buhl and Dienberger in the 50s, when they made the first ascent of Broad Peak, after they did it, they went up to Chogolisa because they were super acclimatized and they were ready to go. And, you know, long story short, in this fog that gets trapped in there, Buhl stepped through a cornice and disappeared, you know, never seen again. And Kurt went on to have this horrific epic getting back to base camp and stuff. So it's kind of a spooky place in that regard. You know, not a lot of people have ever been there. we're up there by ourselves. We've had all this stress to get there, and suddenly this fog rolls in. We can't see anything. We don't know where we are, really, other than somewhere on this big ridge. And we had arranged to have a nightly radio call with Hidden Peak because we didn't really have anybody else, you know, to keep any sort of eye on us. Not that they could do anything if anything went wrong, but at least we had somebody to talk to. So we called down to Hidden Peak. We had a little talk with those guys. And then we left the radio on, and we hear this chatter, something about an accident.
It turned out this was the 1995 tragedy on K2 that killed well-known British climber Alison Hargreaves and multiple others. One of those climbers turned out to be Jeff Lakes, a Canadian alpinist who happened to be close friends with John's partner, Andrew. This, compounded with everything that had led up to this moment, was the final blow. Crushed, freaked out by their position, and completely demoralized and depleted, the duo decided to turn around.
We decided that night that early that evening, we were going to descend, which was its own epic. We decided that the ridge that we had climbed was, we couldn't get back down what we had done for a variety of reasons. And so we decided we were going to traverse out onto this face and try to pick our way down through island of safety to island of safety. We had two pickets and four ice screws and, you know, 5,000 foot face to descend. And it was horrible. You know, Spindrift all night because it had started storming heavy and snow coming down, you know, pushing us off the face and stuff, and big avalanches all over the place. We were just absolutely shattered. The pictures, I have a couple pictures of us the next morning, and we just both look like, you know, we've just come from the front line somewhere. We narrowly missed getting crushed by a huge rock fall. We had stopped at one point to make a camp underneath this little buttress, and it was the first safe place that we had come to all night. And for some reason, we just looked at it and said, eh, let's go to this other one over here. Like, they were almost identical. They were like 100 feet apart. So we moved to the other one. And then in the morning, when the sun came up, we watched that spot just get obliterated as, you know, car-sized blocks just fell down on top of it and just smoked it. So we were pretty shattered coming down from that.
The two friends staggered into base camp, with the weight of the whole experience on their shoulders. Andrew had lost a close friend, and John was convinced he was headed for a Pakistani jail. If things couldn't get worse, the new cook, thinking the duo had been killed on the mountain, had stolen their gear, which, after some awkward conversations, they were able to retrieve most of it back. Completely defeated and demoralized, the climbers started the journey back to Islamabad.
About 2-3 days later, we're walking down the glacier, and it's kind of doom and gloom for Andrew, you know. I think, you know, we were just sort of like, you know, he'd gone over to the Gyokhi Memorial and made a plate for Jeff, and we were thinking, this is really going to not be too fun when we get back to Islamabad. And Porter comes up the Baltar up towards us, and he stops us. You know, we're just kind of going to, we're thinking we're just going to wave, say hi. He goes, are you Mr. Johns? And I said, yes. He goes, a Chogalisa expedition. I said, yes. He takes off his pack. He whips out this FedEx box. He goes, I have a FedEx for you. Please sign here. You know, and I was like in the middle of the Baltar Glacier. I get this FedEx box. It's from my dad. And he's got, you know, he put the New York Times in there, the Wall Street Journal. But inside there was a letter from him. And what I had said in my letter was, please don't come to Pakistan. It's not going to be any help if you come here, and it'll probably make the situation worse. But what I do want you to do is I want you to get a hold of my friend, Ehsan Khan. So Ehsan is a friend of mine who went to college with me, and he's Pakistani, he's from Karachi. And Ehsan, he was living in London at that time, but Ehsan's father was the admiral of the Pakistani Navy. He was the head admiral of the whole Pakistani Navy. He's just totally by chance that I happen to know this person.
In fact, John and Asun had been pretty good friends in college. They'd lived together, maybe done a little partying. They were buddies. And yes, Asun's father was literally the head admiral for the Pakistani Navy. Before the trip, Asun had told John explicitly, if you get into any trouble, let me know.
I said, okay, I will. So my dad had reached out to Asun. Asun had reached out to his dad. And Admiral Khan said that he wanted me to contact him as soon as I got back to Skardu. This was in this kind of official-looking letter. So I thought, well, the tide may finally be turning. So I said, you know, we were talking, Ayub, that night when we got to camp at Erdukas. And I said, so we should be in Skardu tomorrow. And he said, yeah. Oh, he said, yes, it will be good. He goes, and then you may answer for your crimes. You know? And I said, okay. I said, well, do you think we could use the phone when we get there? And he said, yes. You know, I said, I had someone to call in Karachi. He said, who do you know in Karachi? And I said, well, I said, I need to call my friend's father. And I made this big sort of to-do about like reading this letter. I said, his name is Admiral Saeed Khan. And, you know, Ayub, like the color, he just went white and he just looked at me and said, Admiral Saeed Khan? Admiral Saeed Khan. I said, yes. I turned the letter around to him and I said, yes, Admiral Saeed Khan. You see, his son, Asun, and I are close friends. And the admiral would like me to call him. You can see it says right here, as soon as you reach Skardu.
I'm sure you can imagine Captain Ayub immediately flipped a switch, but it still wasn't over. Ayub, the liaison officer who had instilled fear and angst into the expedition for months, most likely knew his goose was cooked. So he started to get a little desperate.
We later found out that he was plotting with his ISI friends, and the ISI is like the Pakistani KGB, but much worse, very feared by people in Pakistan for good reason. And he was going to have and did have us followed, tried to keep us off the plane, tried to keep us from getting a visa to get out of Pakistan and into India. It was just crazy town. But I got Asun's dad on the phone and he said, oh, John, it's good to hear from you. He said, I hear you've had some mistreatment, you know. And I said, well, it's been a little rough. And he said, tell me what's happened. So I walked him through the whole thing and he said, oh, I'm extremely disappointed to hear this. He said, this does not reflect well on Pakistan. And I said, well, I have to agree with you there. It really doesn't, you know. And then there was this long pause. And then he just said, what would you like me to do to this man? And I was just, the way he said it and his voice thing, I just thought, I don't think there's really anything that I could say that the answer would be no to at this point. It was very chilling. And I said, I just don't think that he should be allowed to do this to anyone else ever again. And Admiral, Khan said, I agree. I will take care of it. But then he said something that was really equally chilling. He said, now listen to me. I want you to leave Pakistan as soon as possible. I can do a lot, but even I cannot guarantee your safety here. And I was like, okay, understood, loud and clear.
Eventually, John and Andrew did get out of there, returning home safely to their homes with a hell of a tale to tell. John wrote the classic retelling of this adventure, a story called Dangerous Liaisons. Through the years, John and Andrew remained close friends and meet yearly to go on climbing excursions, albeit a little closer to home. But in their younger years, they had wanted big adventure, and they certainly got it in 1995 on their journey to Chogolisa.
later, several months later, I heard through the grapevine. You know, I heard a couple of things. We had run into Doug Scott when we were in Islamabad, and he heard about this story, and he was working with the Pakistani Mountaineering Association, and he asked us if it was okay if he discussed the story with them, because he said, this is going to destroy this place. This is the, they don't understand that if they don't get this under control, this will destroy this place. You know, so we were able to get out of there. I did hear later that Ayub was heavily demoted. I think he may have even been tossed out of the army or something and discharged. Like, it was rough. It was very rough. And it should have been, because it was rough on us. I think we were lucky that nobody came out of there worse than we did. But yeah, it was an epic adventure. What can I say, you know?
All right, well, thanks for hanging out with me today. I hope you got as much out of John's stories as I did, and I hope you can apply some of his mountain wisdom to your next trip in the Alpine. If you want to learn more about John and Andrew's trip to Chogolisa back in 1995, I'm going to leave some links in the show notes where you can read some of the stories that have been written about that. If you enjoy The Fern Line, make sure to become a subscriber over on Patreon, where you can get early access to episodes and also just support the creation of this show. Also, another way to help out is to leave a review over on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. That really helps get the word out about The Fern Line. All right, everyone, take care. I've got a few more episodes coming up in early 2022. Looking forward to get those to you. In the meantime, be safe out in the mountains. Take care of yourselves. We'll talk to you soon. Peace out.